are doing eschatology, looking at starting in Genesis, going through all the books in chronological order, just looking at the prophecies, talking about eschatology or the end times. Not just prophecies about things that will take place in the future. There's many things that are predicted as signs and things that took place in the generation or the generation after it was said. But now we are in Daniel, and Daniel's got a variety of verses here that we'll look at. In fact, I've printed this off for you. I've got this right here, the same thing you see on the board. I've got a little sheet right there. Those are the eschatological verses minus Daniel chapter 1:1, which just kind of introduces the book and Daniel's in captivity. And then also in chapter 9 and 10, there's some verses there talking about the Seleucids, Ptolemy, the Maccabean revolt during that time period. And that's not really eschatology. It ends up switching into the future, the distant future. But that, I got that written down. I want to read through it. But it's kind of interesting because it kind of lays the flavor or the climate that you saw in 165 B.C. during the Maccabean revolt with the Seleucids Empire from the north coming down out of Syria, the Ptolemy Empire in Egypt, and the two fighting back and forth, trying to use Israel as a buffer zone and forcing the Hellenistic ways on Israel. And that's a very clear type of the Antichrist. In fact, the abomination of desolation takes place there, but yet it's going to be a future event. So it's kind of interesting to see those verses. But anyway, I also printed off for you a few pages out of the framework book, page 136, beginning in it's chapter 22, but in 604 B.C., and I've got about 8 pages there. It's put on 4 pages for you, but it's a timeline from 640, and I stop at 521, and what you have there is the book of Daniel takes place in that time frame. So if we were to begin in Daniel chapter 1, verse 1, you can look on your notes right here if you want to follow the time frame. That would be the second page of the first page, or the year 605, Daniel chapter 1. It begins by saying, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem. Now, at that time, his father is still the king. Nabopolassar is still the king in 605. And Nebuchadnezzar is the general of his father's military from Babylon. He comes in, sweeps down through Syria into Israel, and takes Jerusalem, and has taken captive the royal children. Not so much to put them in chains and make them slaves, as much as to take them back as guarantee, kind of as hostages, but also to train them to become ambassadors and negotiators for him, and kind of, you know, incorporate them into his government as he begins to conquer the Middle East. Well, that's chapter 1, and Daniel's taken in with his friends. And then during that chapter, the next year, in 604, Nebuchadnezzar has to go back and put down a revolt in Syria, and he returns, and the boys have gone through some training. Now, Daniel, I've got this written down here, that Daniel was 16 years old on these notes on the board. In the framework book, I suggest that he's 18 years old. We don't know how old he is, but he's probably not 25, he's not 30, but I don't think he's 6 or 7 years old. So 16, 18 years old is an interesting, probably appropriate number. But that gives you now a frame reference to see how old he is throughout the book, because our last chapter is going to take place in 536 B.C., which would put him, if he's 16 in 605, he'd be 85 in 536. If he's 18 here, of course, he's 87. So it lets you know that Daniel, when he gets thrown in the lion's den by the Persians, he's an 80-year-old man. He's in his 80s. He's not an 18-year-old kid. And so Daniel in 605 is one of the royal children in Jerusalem related to the tribe of Judah. And he's taken by Nebuchadnezzar during the Assyrian Empire. Nebuchadnezzar has not defeated the Assyrian Empire at Carchemish yet. So the Assyrians are ruling. Their empire is, you know, declining, but they're in power. Egypt is trying to support the Assyrians. Daniel is from Judah. He's an Israelite of the royal family. Nebuchadnezzar is going to defeat Carchemish, or the Assyrians at Carchemish, which puts Nebuchadnezzar in the driver's seat. His father, Nabopolassar, dies. And Nebuchadnezzar begins, during right here in 605, 604, he begins his reign as the king of the Babylonian Empire. And Daniel now is in Babylon as a hostage or as a student in the Babylonian Empire. He's going to be there the whole time until we get down into the 539. This is when you're going to see Belshazzar, which is going to be Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. We could say it this way. His father has put him in charge, and we'll see that here in a moment. And he is the last king of Babylon, and he is then overrun that evening by the Persians. And Daniel then continues as an employee, as an ambassador in a cabinet position for Darius, who's the king of Babylon, under the emperor Cyrus the Persian. So he goes from the Assyrian Empire as a royal child of Judah, as a captive of the Babylonian Empire, trained in as an ambassador, as one of the royal figures or servants in the cabinet for Nebuchadnezzar, and then into the Persian Empire. So Daniel's going to see the Assyrians, the full Babylonian Empire, and the beginning of the Persian Empire, and he's right in the driver's seat, right there in the palace the whole time with either the kings of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, and the royal family that follows, and then Cyrus and Darius, the Persians. So that's chapter 1, beginning that. In chapter 2 is one of our first eschatological verses. It's going to be chapter 2 in 604. Nebuchadnezzar is going to have a dream. We're going to come back and read that, and that's where he's going to see the statue made of gold or of the different metals. Chapter 3 is the year that we're not real sure what year that is, but it would seem like it'd be right after the vision. Maybe Nebuchadnezzar, if you read the notes here from the framework book, Nebuchadnezzar's brother revolts against him while Nebuchadnezzar is in Syria putting down a revolt there. And back in Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar's brother revolts against him, and he puts that revolt down. And that may have been the time that he sets up the statue and demands that everyone worship the statue. And that would be in the framework book, page 138. We're on the second page of the notes I handed out. And that would be in 604, 603. I don't have that written down in there because we're not sure exactly, but it would have to be right around that time period. So that's Daniel chapter 1 and 2. And then the statue in chapter 3, that's just a historical account. And again, interesting in chapter 3, Daniel's not mentioned in chapter 3. What did Daniel do when the golden statue was put up and everyone's supposed to bow down? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, his three friends that were with him in Judah that were taken captive, they refused to bow down and were thrown into the fiery furnace, you know the story, and were delivered from that. Where was Daniel? No one knows where Daniel was. Was he bowing down? Highly unlikely. Some would suggest that he'd already been sent off as an ambassador or was in Susa or one of the other major cities in doing some kind of delegation or royal work. And again, that's all speculation. But Daniel is not in the story, although he was right in the midst and the thick of things there, along with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Chapter 4, you can jump ahead in your framework notes there. That's around the year 570, towards the end of Nebuchadnezzar's life, and he's going to have a dream. That's the dream of the tree. Now, that's prophecy, but it's not a prophecy eschatological. It's a prophecy of Nebuchadnezzar's life, and it's fulfilled in Nebuchadnezzar's life. And there is some references to this event, even in the writings of the Babylonians, that there's a time period where Nebuchadnezzar kind of became senile for a while, and others were ruling his kingdom. There's cuneiform writings. We can see right here is a cuneiform writing in the British Museum of Nebuchadnezzar recording his destruction of Jerusalem. Here is Belshazzar's name written on Nabonidus's, the father records his son. This is a replica in cuneiform writing of his son. His name is mentioned there. Only place it was mentioned ever in history was in the Bible until archaeology began to find cuneiform, and the book of Daniel took some heat, especially in the 1800s. And we'll get to this one too. That's Cyrus's cylinder, and that's coming up later in 539. Anyway, there's his dream about, you know, he's supposed to humble himself under God, and he becomes proud, and he goes through the dream is fulfilled in chapter 4, verse 28, right around 569. Then in chapter 5, there's writing on the wall. We're going to come back to that. That's in 539. So now chapter 5 jumps way ahead to the Persian Empire. That's Belshazzar's the party on the wall when Cyrus came in and overthrew it. Chapter 6 is 538. The following year, that's when he's an old man in the 80s. That's when he's thrown in the lions then because he continues to worship God. And it's not a religious persecution. there are people that are jealous of Daniel because he's so outstanding in his performance as one of the leaders that they're trying to bring him down. And they conspire against him, using his religion against him. They weren't anti-Jewish necessarily. They were just trying to use Daniel's religion to take him down. Then chapter 7, that's again a dream that takes place in 553. We'll read through that. That's when he's going to see the beast coming out of the sea. And that's a very important eschatological passage there in Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 8, he's going to now see the ram and the goat vision, where that's going to take place in 551, right around that time period. And again, we talk about it, the year. Sometimes our 12-month year is only like 6 months of their 12-month year. So maybe it'd be two, it include the 12 months of theirs, it would be two of their years, depending on how they date it. And you've got the dating of the Babylonians or the Middle East, the Chaldeans. You've got the dating of the Jews and their kings, how they date. It all's within secret. It's all within months. But a lot of times the numbers aren't, they don't break off on January 1st and December 31st like ours do. Daniel chapter 9, now you're in 539. And this is where Daniel is going to pray. He's been studying the book of Jeremiah, realizes it's time to go back. And then you're going to have chapter 9, 10, 11, and 12 of all prophecy verses. And so you can see the sequence of Daniel is not in chronological order. It's arranged differently. And this chart right here kind of gives you some of those details of this. Again, a lot of things I'd like to say about 539. On the very last page, it'd be on your framework book, page 142, the last page of the notes, is 539. That's when Nabonidus was the king, and this is the last known historical recorded king of Babylon in the Babylonian Empire, Nabonidus, which would have been Nebuchadnezzar's son-in-law, because he would have married, Nabonidus would have married Nitocris, which was Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. And she is going to be the lady who walks out into the party, and they say there's this handwriting, and it's Nebuchadnezzar's daughter, who now is a grandmother, says, well, when your father was the king, or it would be, you know, when her husband's father was the king, he had a man named Daniel, and they go find Daniel, and they bring him out. Now, he's 80 years old, and he reads the writing on the wall. And Nabonidus, that's who wrote this. And there's several of these that have been found, writings of Nabonidus. Now, they used to write on flat tablets like this, but then they got the idea, they upgraded the tablet into a cylinder, so instead of writing on flat and stacking tablets, they could do like this. It's a bit like scrolling down your Facebook page on your phone. They could read like this. They got more, you know, they could stack them up easier. But in this is Nabonidus talking about his son, Belshazzar. And on these notes, you can see that in 539, Nabonidus leaves Babylon and goes south because the Persians are coming. And they know they're falling. They know the empire is collapsing. So he leaves Belshazzar, his son, which is only mentioned in Scripture and nowhere else in history, until archaeology brought these things up, and now it mentions Belshazzar. And Belshazzar was there on October 12th. Belshazzar's having a drunken party. They're surrounded. All the cities have fallen. The only thing left standing is Babylon with the double wall, and it's like they can't even leave. They're like in lockdown. And so he's having a party, and while they're using the vessels from the temple that was destroyed in 586, and you can read the notes right there. You know the story in the Bible. The words meeny, tekel, parson were written on the wall. No one can read it. Everybody's freaking out. And that's when Nitocris comes out and says, your grandfather, when he had a question like this, a dream or something, Daniel, a man named Daniel, if you can find Daniel, he can tell you. By that time, they have no interest in Daniel and his skill set or in his God. And they bring Daniel in and he reads it. And Belshazzar, interestingly, right in the text of Scripture, tells him, I'll make you third in the kingdom. Now, again, why doesn't he tell him, I'll make you second in the kingdom? Well, because his father is still the king. Nabonidus is still the king, although he's moved south trying to get away from the military pressure. And Belshazzar is second. He's king of Babylon under his father, and he could put Daniel. So it all lines up historically and accurately with archaeology, with the way that it all works. Now we're going to begin looking at these verses eschatologically. 605 is just chapter 1 talking about where Daniel came from. But our eschatological verses begin in 603 in chapter 2. And we could begin in chapter 2, and here's the vision, chapter 2, verse 1, in the second year of his reign. So in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, if he became king after his father died in 605, it'd be 604, 603, depending on the months, how you count it. Nebuchadnezzar is now, he's king of Babylon, the new empire. He's just defeated the Assyrians. They're now crumbled. Egypt has fled back. They're not subdued yet, but they're contained. And Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and you know the dream. We're going to see the dream, and he comes out. I'm not going to read all the narration of it, but he comes out and he calls the astrologers, the wise men, and says, "Hey, tell me my dream. Interpret the dream for me." Now, some would say that Nebuchadnezzar couldn't remember the dream, and he wanted the wise men to tell him the dream, or couldn't remember the dream, and he wants the wise men to tell him the dream and find out what was this dream that's tormenting me. He wants an interpretation. I think when you read this, and you can study it yourself and listen to other teachers, Nebuchadnezzar knows the dream, but he knows the dream is important. He knows it's got meaning. They believe these things, that dreams were messages from the gods. But he knows also, and this comes up especially during the Persian time, these astrologers were political players. And they would use their powers and their manipulation, if you want to call it false media. They could tell the king whatever. He's got a question about an interpretation. Well, they can interpret whatever they want because they've got this magical power. And he knows enough, and he's a player right here. This guy, Nebuchadnezzar, he's a general from the military. And he's already had a revolt he's had to put down. He knows these guys are trying to get political power. They've had power in other situations. And he tells them, no. You can see how serious he is. He says, no, you tell me the dream, and then you tell me the interpretation. And I'll know you're telling me the correct interpretation and that you've got skill when you can tell me my dream. They go, oh, king, no one's ever asked us to do that. Nowhere in the history of the world has a king ever asked his wise men to tell them the dream before we interpret it. It goes like this. You tell us the dream, and we interpret it. He goes, no, I know what you're up to. I'm going to kill all of you. And now he gives out the issue that all the wise men, all the astrologers are going to be executed because he knows it's a political play. Now, Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach are part of the astrologers. They've been being trained with the wise men, and now they're going to be executed. You can read down in here. Well, in verse 8, then the king answered, I am certain that you are trying to gain time because you realize that this is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me the dream, there is just one penalty for you. You have conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things. I figured out you're false media, hoping the situation will change. So then, tell me the dream and I will know that you can interpret it for me. The astrologers answered the king, there's not a man on earth who can do what the king asked. This made the king so angry, verse 12, that he was furious that he ordered the execution of all of them. Verse 14, when Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. In other words, he didn't freak out. He said, wisdom and tact. Like, what seems to be the problem? Why are we getting our heads cut off today? And why did the king issue such a harsh decree? And he explained to him, Daniel says, hey, give me a chance. He says, I'm going to plead with my God and see if he will tell me the dream. And sure enough, and then you've got all this. You've got the Daniel receiving the dream. He appears before Nebuchadnezzar, and that's where we pick up in chapter 27. The king asked in chapter 2, verse 26, the king asked Daniel, also called Belteshazzar. Now, don't get that confused with Belshazzar. The wicked king of the drunken party. The names are similar. They're Babylonian names. Daniel's got a Babylonian name now. Are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream and interpret? Notice, can you tell me what I saw? That's my test to know if you're legitimate. And then I'll accept your interpretation. Daniel replied, no wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he has asked about. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in days to come. Your dream and the visions that pass through your mind as you lay on your bed are these. As you were lying there, O king, your mind turned to things to come. Again, when it says things to come, this is not going to take place in Nebuchadnezzar's reign. It's going to start, but it's going to go all the way to the end of history. I mean, it's a great dream. It's basically all of eschatology is based from this point on is based on this. You need to understand this to even unravel Revelation. these are the things of mystery. As for me, this mystery was revealed to me not because I have greater wisdom than other living men, but so that you, O king, may know the interpretation and that you may understand what went through your mind. In other words, it's very clear. God wants you to know this. This is not because I'm a great man or to bring me praise or have a book named after me. This is for you, Nebuchadnezzar, to understand what's going to unfold beginning with you throughout all of history. You looked, O king, and there before you stood a large statue, an enormous, dazzling statue, awesome in appearance. The head of the statue was made of pure gold, and its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of baked clay. While you were watching, a rock was cut out, but not by human hands. That's important. A rock was cut out, not by human hands. It struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and smashed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold were broken to pieces at the same time and became like chaff on a threshing floor in the summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace, but the rock that was not cut out by human hands, the rock that struck the statue became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream, and now we, interesting, he does use the word we, now we will interpret it to the king. Now when he says we, the best guess is he's talking about him and God, because he says God has revealed this mystery, and now with God's help, I will now interpret the dream for you and tell you what it means. Some would say maybe he's talking about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, because they were with him, they were praying with him the evening before this happened. But as you know, here's the statue again. Please forgive the drawing, of course. And got some pointy toes right here tonight. All right. And then here's this rock that's going to be cut out, that's going to come in. This is gold, the head of gold. This is silver, the chest. The waist is bronze, and the legs are iron, and down here, the feet are iron and clay. And the stone is going to strike the statue here. The whole thing's going to crumble, and the wind is going to blow away the pieces, and the rock is going to become a mountain. Now, as we go through this, mountains in prophecy, again, you always got to consider what you're reading, and you don't want to just make general statements, but mountains refer to kingdoms. They refer to empires. Oftentimes, the empire or the kingdom and the king are interchangeable. Sometimes, the head of gold is going to be Nebuchadnezzar, but it also represents the Babylonian Empire. Silver is going to represent Cyrus or the Persians. So it's like, we're talking about Cyrus, we're talking about the Persians. So they're interchangeable. The leader and his kingdom go together. Just like this rock is going to be Jesus or the Messiah, but it's also going to represent the Messiah's kingdom. So one place it's rock not cut out by human hands, so it's a divine source. It's not a human. These are all going to have human kings. This is going to have a divine king, and it's going to become a divine kingdom. So now let's let Daniel interpret this. And again, this is going to be repeated with the animal vision coming up later. This is the dream, and now we will interpret it. Verse 37. You, O king, Nebuchadnezzar, are the king of kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power and might and glory. In your hands he has placed mankind and the beasts of the field and the birds of the air. Wherever they live, he has made you ruler over them. You are that head of gold. So Nebuchadnezzar is that head of gold, or the Babylonian Empire. After you, another kingdom will rise inferior to yours. Next, a third kingdom of one of bronze will rule over the whole earth. Finally, there will be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, for iron breaks and smashes everything, and as iron breaks things to pieces, so it will crush and break all the others. Just as you saw that the feet and toes were partly of baked clay and partly of iron, so this will be a divided kingdom. Yet it will have some of the strength of iron in it, even as you saw iron mixed with clay. Now we'll stop there. One thing to point out about this is he's pointing out here that these kingdoms, this is Babylon or Nebuchadnezzar. This is Persia, beginning with Cyrus. This is Greece, beginning with Alexander, and we're going to see later on that's going to divide into four divisions Lysimachus, Cassanders, Ptolemy, Seleucus are going to divide the kingdom. We'll talk about that in the next vision. And then Rome is going to be the kingdom of iron. And this right here is the feet of baked clay. And the baked clay, that's exactly what it means. It doesn't mean clay like clay putty. It means baked. It means like it's glazed. It's finished. It's decorative. And iron. And with several things you can say about that. First of all, baked clay or glazed clay, it's brittle. You drop it, it shatters. But you're also going to use it for it's very cultural. It's very decorative. So, just understand, it's not talking about just clay, like clay dirt, or you mold things with clay. It's not talking about the clay of a potter's wheel. It's talking about some kind of decorative clay, like glazing you may put on a wall in the kingdom of Babylon, in the city that he's building. They'd have glazed tile, and it's mixed with iron. And iron, and again, the point here, it says very clearly, each kingdom is going to be inferior. You are the head of gold. And each kingdom is going to become more inferior. But historically, I don't know the answer to this, but here, this is the facts. Gold is more precious, most valuable, silver, bronze, iron, and then iron and baked clay. So there's more of the most valuable thing here. But as you go through these, Babylon ruled the smallest territory, because each kingdom expanded the territory. You can check your maps in your Bibles. You can check the maps in your history book in your university. Each empire, it got larger. Look at Rome. Rome, I mean, the whole Mediterranean world. So Babylon was the smallest. And it was the shortest. It was so short that Daniel was 18 years old or 16 years old when it began, and he's 80 years old when it falls apart, and he moves into the Persian Empire. So Daniel lives this entire reign. Rome, if you want to say, pick out a year that it began, and when did it fall? The Byzantine Empire, or, Rome fell in 400 AD, and it goes back, say 200, when do you want to have Rome starting? 100 AD, 50 or BC? And then the western half didn't fall until the 1500s, when Constantinople fell, as some people dated. So Rome was definitely the largest and the longest, and these all fell in between. Persia had more territory and ruled longer than Babylon. Greece had more territory and ruled longer than Persia. And Rome was the largest and ruled longer. So inferior, they were all larger and ruled longer. The thing that is different, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but it may set up the explanation of these feet of iron and clay. We're about to read it. Is this, and we just saw it. That's why it was important to read what we read. When Nebuchadnezzar wanted his dream interpreted, and the astronomers, the wise men, they wouldn't do it, he says, I want you all executed. Start cutting off heads. But when Daniel interpreted it, Nebuchadnezzar says, okay, you all can live. Nebuchadnezzar had absolute power. He could make a decree, kill everyone, and then say, oh, I changed my mind. No, it was all the power rested with the king, Nebuchadnezzar. If you remember, the Persians, and that's where Daniel's going to have a problem. That's why Daniel gets thrown in the lion's den. It's interesting that these answers to this decline may be within the book of Daniel. Darius, The guys that were conspiring against Daniel when he's 80-some years old, they didn't like the fact that he had so much influence. So they came to Darius, and they asked him, they says, we would like to make a decree that no one can pray to any god except you. Just kind of like it'll be like Darius month, we're just to kind of celebrate you, and you're just doing such a great job. And he goes, sure, sounds good. Now, if anybody doesn't worship you and they pray to any other god, we'll throw him in the lion's den. Darius said, well, I really appreciate the recognition. I'd love to have a Darius parade and a Darius month. So he signs the decree. Then they go out and they wait for Daniel to pray to God, looking to Jerusalem, looking back towards Jerusalem. And they say, we go, Darius, bad news. I know you love Daniel. I know he's one of your top guys, but we just caught him praying. Darius says, oh, no. Is there anything we can do? He says, King, we wish we could do something, but you signed the decree. And as you know, we've made some improvements since the Babylonians. If an emperor makes a decree, if a king makes a decree, he can't just on a whim change it. It is a decree. And Darius, we read the story, Darius was like just very upset. In fact, he couldn't sleep all night. He asked for musicians. He asked for all kinds of things. He couldn't sleep. And in the morning, he rushes out. It was, Daniel, was your God able to save you? Because he couldn't change, Darius couldn't change his own decree. And there's another story like that in Esther, where the emperor then, Xerxes, he makes a rule, another rule, that where the Jews were going to be plundered on a certain day. This is the book of Esther. And when he realizes Esther is a Jew, he can't change his decree, but he can make a rule, another decree that says the Jews can defend themselves. So while you're plundering them, they're going to be fighting back. And it all balanced out. So absolute power, limited power, you know, with the decrees. Greece, you're getting a form of democracy. You always talk about democracy. The people are starting to rule. Rome, you've got the emperor, but they're under control of the Senate. There's that constant tension with the Rome and the Senate. And now you get down in here, it's the people can't even unite. That's going to be the problem. Unite, they cannot unite. Iron mixed with clay. The power, the governmental power, it ends up becoming, in a sense, democracy, but mob rule, if you would. And that's where this ends up right here. And that matches in Thessalonians, where we're talking about it on Tuesday nights. We haven't got there in our study here. But the day coming with the man of lawlessness, up here there was absolute law. It was ruled by, we're not promoting, you know, dictators. But down here, the point here is it's going to become more and more unstable. It can't be the territory. It can't be the length. The thing I see deteriorating is the governmental structure and able to hold firm without just getting so watered down. Nonetheless, that is one of the things that takes place right here, showing the flow of history into chaos. And the light. Well, here, I'll just read it. Verse 42, as the toes were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom, this final form of the kingdom, not Babylon, Persia, Greece, or Rome, but one that this part is yet future. We've seen all these. We're still waiting for this. And that's another interesting conversation. And just as you saw the iron mixed with baked clay, so the people will be a mixture and will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. And again, iron was strong, military, crushing everything, but the clay was baked clay, decorative, kind of cultural. And you've got like this military state mixed with this cultural state. I mean, I'm almost wondering, when you see the two legs, people wonder if one's the East and the West, the Roman Empire. You know, one would be still the militant state. One is the Western side, more cultural. We've got this. And you try and unite them, they're not going to mix together. That's speculation. In the time of those kings, in the time of these feet, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end. That's this rock that's going to strike right here. That is when this Messiah, this rock, is not coming in the Babylon, the Persia, the Greek, or the Roman. It's coming right here. It's going to crush all this. This is the meaning of the vision of the rock cut out of a mountain, but not by human hands. A rock that broke the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and gold to pieces. The great God has shown the king what will take place in the future. The dream is true, and the interpretation is trustworthy. Then Nebuchadnezzar fell prostrate before Daniel and paid him honor and order that an offering and incense be presented to him. The king said to Daniel, surely your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery. Then the king placed Daniel in the high position and lavished many gifts on him. So again, Daniel, that's Daniel starting out with gifts. This is in 605, early in the empire. That's where Daniel starts off. And he's going to continue to rule and reign. As the kingdom declines, the Babylonian kingdom declines, he gets pushed off the side. But when the Persians come in, they pick him up and he ends up. And there's no doubt that Daniel lived a very luxurious life in palaces with all kinds of trinkets, but yet he remained very faithful. Okay, that's that chapter right there. Any comments on that? That's just showing what's going to take place, and this is important because we're going to pick it up again later. Now we go to Daniel chapter 7. In Daniel chapter 4, that's the vision of the tree, Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Daniel chapter 5, we're going to come back to. Oh, no, we're not going to come back to Daniel chapter 5 because that's the fall. That's an interpretation of a prophecy, but that's the handwriting on the wall. That was just for that night. That was a prophecy and interpretation for that moment in history. It was like, you know, 90 minutes ahead of time. Then chapter 6, that's Daniel in the lion's den in the Persian Empire. Then Daniel chapter 7, verse 1. Now this is in the year, chapter 7 is in the year 553. So we jump from 605 to 553. Get that in your mind. We're jumping 50 some years. I mean, this is Daniel had this vision, and then he served Nebuchadnezzar throughout his reign. And now about 50 years later, 52 years later, we have now Daniel chapter 7. So chapter 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Now that's where the critics got upset, and they said, well, that's not true. There is no king named Belshazzar. The last king of Babylon was Nabonidus. That's in 539. You got his name written there on page 142. It was Nabonidus. And that's what history records. But then we find out that Nabonidus moved south and put Belshazzar in charge. He was the king of Babylon, the city. Nabonidus was king of the crumbling empire. And Nabonidus had married Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. And so Belshazzar was Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. But anyway, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions passed through his mind. Now things are just getting ready to just collapse. The Babylon Empire is on its way out. Daniel's lived 50 years in luxury in the Babylonian Empire. Now he's got a corrupt king and an idiot grandson on the throne. And he had visions pass through his mind as he was lying on his bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. Now this is interesting. He got up and wrote down what he had dreamed. Now understand, even according to Peter writing the New Testament, the prophets didn't always understand the visions. In fact, the book of Daniel ends with that very thing. Daniel asking questions. What does this mean? How can this happen? He says, go your way, Daniel. So when he has the vision, he knows it's important. Just like Nebuchadnezzar knew his dream was important, but I have no idea what it means. Daniel brought that meaning. Now, Daniel's going to have visions, and it's like, okay, I'm just writing this thing down, but I don't understand what it means. Daniel said, in my vision at night. Now, this would, I assume, it says he wrote down the substance of his dream. When chapter 7, verse 2, Daniel said, in my vision at night, you're assuming now you're actually reading his journal of what he wrote. You understand what I'm saying? He's not like explaining this to someone at a church service. Someone's got a hold of his vision journal, and this is what Daniel said in his book, in his scroll, on his cuneiform tablet. Daniel said, wouldn't it be cool to find this, huh? In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me were four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Now, there's going to be some interpretation coming here. I'm going to make some comments as we go. Now, right here, what you're seeing right here is the four winds of heaven. That's what God is using to control, and the sea is the nations. You can say the world, but the sea is the nations, the world culture. And the winds churning it up is God's four winds, angelic powers, churning up, confusing. And God does it throughout history. You see God coming, Zechariah is a great book, where God will cause turmoil to move history in the direction he wants it to move. Now, we're in a culture, peace, peace, we all want peace, can't we just stay normal? God doesn't want normal, God doesn't want things to stay the way they are. God is moving towards his kingdom. So when everybody gets all safe and peaceful, all settled down, I love my life just like this, don't change anything, God, this is not the kingdom. This is not my plan for you. And he'll churn things up and keep you moving. Now, again, that's historical. Now, just imagine, you know, if you want to make that application in your life, everything's really good. It's like, yeah, you're not where I want you to be. You've got to stir the pot a little bit. Okay, there's your personal application from prophecy. I looked, and there before me were four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the other, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood up on 2 feet like a man, and the heart of a man was given to it. And there before me was a second beast. Now, again, what we're seeing right here is this first beast. This is Nebuchadnezzar. And he comes up, God's churning it up. You got the Assyrian Empire is collapsing. Egypt is trying to support him. Nebuchadnezzar's father, is trying to take some ground. He's winning some battles. And the things are being churned up. And the whole thing about the heart of a man was given to that probably refers to the fact that Nebuchadnezzar humbled himself and found the Lord through Daniel and the dreams that he had. And he became a man instead of just one of the beasts that God was using to control history. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its side, and it had three ribs in its mouth. And that would be Babylon, Lydia, and Egypt. And what is there? It's up on one side. It doesn't mean it's laying on one side. It's a bear in running motion, potentially. It's a bear. It's the Persians moving in on Babylon and then going up into Turkey area where it takes out the Persians, or excuse me, Lydia and Egypt. Three ribs, that's the three kingdoms it had in its mouth, between its teeth. It was told, get up and eat your fill of flesh, the flesh being the other kingdom. And now the Assyrian Empire is going to take over a larger territory. After that, I looked, and there before me was another beast. Now, these beasts are kings. They're rulers. They're leaders of empires, which is going to help you understand, at least keep that in mind when you go to Revelation and start hearing about beasts coming in the Revelation, the first beast or the second beast. They're power, world powers, leaders that are basically animals. And that's what's interesting about Nebuchadnezzar. He became a man. He is now recognized as a man, and which means he was no longer just a mere beast ruling an empire. After that, I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard. This is Alexander the Great in the Grecian Empire. And on its back, it had four wings like those of a bird. The beast had four heads, and it was given authority to rule. So again, you've got coming, you can interpret these different ways, but this is kind of the standard interpretation. Alexander coming quickly as a young man, moving quickly across the Middle East, conquering, and had four heads. His kingdom, he's going to refer to it later on, he's going to die at a young age in his 30s, and his kingdom is going to be divided into four parts to the four generals. And then that's where the Seleucids and the Ptolemies come from and the Maccabean revolt. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast. Now, this is what's going to scare Daniel. Terrifying and frightening and very powerful. This is Daniel writing in his journal, potentially, his vision journal. Terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. Now, this is interesting. The others were like animals, beasts. They had wings. They had heads. But this is iron. Now, it matches the legs of iron. It crushed and devoured its victims. And again, that's what the iron legs did, crushing everything, and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from the former beast, and it had 10 horns. Now, when it says it is different, that's important. Now, what that means, you've got 1, 2, 3, 4 beasts. This beast comes and leaves. This beast comes, the bear comes, does its job, it leaves. It's replaced by the leopard with the four wings, and it goes off into four kingdoms, but it leaves. Now, this beast was terrifying. It crushed everything. It was different than the other beast. And then it goes on and says, the next line, it says, it was different than the other beast, former beast, and it had 10 horns. Now, the 10 horns is going to end up becoming 10 horns. Usually, horns like mountains refer to kingdoms. Horns can refer to rulers or individual people. So this would be 10. Again, you don't have to accept this, but, this is symbolic. It's got meaning. It's not just an ugly beast. It's got 10 horns. So this one, which is going to be Rome, this is Greece, this is going to become 10. And it's different than the others. One thing that's possible, and it fits in here, and again, I'm making this work with some of the other visions Daniel has. What's different about this is this beast may come to an end, but it's going to be different because it's going to come back again, or we've now moved. In other words, where we're at in history, this has happened, this has happened, this has happened, this has happened, but we haven't seen these 10 horns yet. Now, some would want to try to find the 10 Caesars this matches. Start with Julius Caesar and find the 10 Caesars. And you can do that if you want to. But as we go through this, it would appear, because this is going to come up again in another vision, that this is the eschatological part of it. This is known as the age of the Gentiles. Jesus said the Temple Mount would be trampled on during the time of the Gentiles. And it was destroyed in 586 by Nebuchadnezzar. And it's remained destroyed. Of course, there's that time after the Persian Cyrus. Right here, he sends the people back. It's engraved on here. He sends the peoples back. The Bible records that he sent them back to build the temple, the Jews. Here he talks to all the people that the Babylonians had taken captive. On the Cyrus scroll, he sends them back to their homelands. And so the temple is going to be rebuilt here, only to be destroyed again here by the Romans in 70 AD. So this is the time period of the Gentiles. It is the Gentile period. So it's during this time, from 586 until the end of time, this is the age of the Gentiles, where the Gentiles are going to be ruling and trembling. And today, the temple courts, the Temple Mount is trampled on. The Muslims control it. And it's considered by the Jews and by Scripture this would be part of the trampling. They've got their own religious system. The Dome of the Rock is there. And it's going to, but this is going to come to an end sometime after these 10 rulers takes place. Nonetheless, that's where we're at. I'll continue reading this. While I was thinking about the 10 horns, now watch this, verse 8, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and three of the first horns were uprooted before it. This horn, so now, out of these 10 horns, there's going to come up one more horn, and this one horn is going to take out three. I'll just write three is crossed off. And now there's only seven. Now, if these are kingdoms, you've got this one horn that destroys three and replace it. Now there's eight. And again, this one little horn, Daniel's going to be concerned. Daniel's going to be concerned about that. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and three of the first horns were uprooted before it. It destroyed, dethroned, killed, executed, assassinated, I don't know. The horn had eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth that spoke boastfully. So when you see this little horn, it's going to be very boastful. It's going to you know, make great claims. And then the very next thing that takes place, watch this, very next thing that takes place. As I looked, Daniel says, now he goes into some kind of poetry or prose. It says, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. At this point in history, remember the rock that's cut out without human hands and strikes the statue? This is the same point right here. Just a little more detail, you've got this fourth beast, becomes 10 rulers. It's different than the other three beasts. This 10 rulers gives way for one ruler who eliminates three. And at this point is where the kingdom comes. The kingdom of the Messiah comes right here. It's the stone. But now we got a few more details about this. It says, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. Now, the Ancient of Days, that's God. Is that God the Father? Could be, because watch this. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. What you see here is very similar to what Ezekiel saw, the chariot of God. And what you see in the beginning of Revelation chapter 4, the fire, the throne, the one sitting on it. But in Revelation, the Lamb appears. In Ezekiel, you see all of these things, including the sea. But it says right here, a river of fire was flowing from before him. When it says thousands upon thousands attended him, that most likely is angels attending and taking care of the situation around the throne of God. And it says 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. Now, that could be a different than the thousands that were attending him. These are standing before him. If you're standing before a throne, it's possible you're waiting to hear from the throne. You're waiting to hear the speech. You're waiting to hear the decision. In this case, it's a judgment. It says 10,000. So I would think the thousands are angels. The 10,000 times 10,000 are believers or saints, or at least mankind. Again, I'm giving you some ideas. The court was seated and the books, plural, were opened. Well, there it is. the throne has been seated right here. The first thing you see right here is the kingdom is appearing and the court is seated. We are in a court situation and we are bringing judgment. Judgment maybe to believers, maybe to all mankind, but a court is seated and judgment is about to take place. God is on his throne. Now watch this right here. Because Jesus referred to this and the high priest knew exactly what he was talking about. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. So this horn is still boasting and talking while the court is being seated and is observing this. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beast had been stripped of their authority but were allowed to live for a period of time. Now, it's like, these three, at this judgment, the beast is taken and immediately eliminated. These three were put off for judgment until later. It lines up with some other verse we could look at. Now here it is, verse 13. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man. In all this thing, like, what's causing this? The court is seated, the Ancient of Days is there, but all of a sudden, this one like the son of man appears. Coming with the clouds of heaven. And that's exactly what Jesus... He says, tell us plainly, are you the Messiah? Jesus says, you'll see me coming in clouds of glory. And at that point, they freaked out. Because what he's saying is, are you the Messiah? He says, you'll see me when you see this verse fulfilled. I will be the Son of Man coming in clouds of glory. And it's like, we don't need any more. We've heard all we need. We don't need a trial. This man deserves to die. So this, and again, interesting, Jesus ascended from the Mount of Olives, and what it says very clearly, and disappeared into the clouds, which is a buzzword. He talked about talking points and buzzwords when he ascends and goes into the clouds, and then the angel says, does Jesus you saw leave? He's going to come back the same way. He disappeared in the clouds. He's coming back in the clouds. This is the Messiah, and go tell everyone. So, I mean, it all makes sense. He approached the Ancient of Days, so the Son of Man, well, it looks like the Son of Man, approaches the Ancient of Days on this throne. So again, there's two persons. And he was led into his presence. In other words, he was welcome. Remember Revelation, the Lamb appeared that had been slain and was led into his presence and given the scroll. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. This Son of Man, the one that appeared like a Son of Man, was given basically the throne of God. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. So there is that. That's the vision that Daniel wrote that down, and now he's trying to piece this together. Now again, it'd be nice if Daniel could explain this and we could ask questions, but I do believe, and you can disagree with this, that Daniel understood, he understood this more than I understand it, but Daniel was still trying to put the pieces, that's why he wrote it down, so he can review it and think about it and try to put it together with Jeremiah's words. Ezekiel's active at this time. Ezekiel's already been writing during this whole time period. Now it goes on and says, I, Daniel, was troubled in spirit, and the visions that passed through my mind disturbed me. In other words, okay, what was his reaction? Well, that makes a lot of sense. Now I feel a lot better because I understand what's going to take place. Daniel's reaction was like, oh my gosh, this is disturbing. I can't get it out of my head. I don't know what this means. It says, disturbed me. I approached one of those standing there, which would probably be an angelic figure in the vision, and asked him the true meaning of all this. So he told me and gave me the interpretation of these things. Well, there we go. Now you heard me stumble through it. Now here's what appears to be an angel explaining the vision to Daniel. That he goes, he's disturbed. I mean, this is not a comforting thing. This is like, this bothers him. He sees a lot of turmoil, beasts coming out of a sea that's been stirred up, and they're devouring kingdoms, and they're killing rulers, and they're being judged by this coming eschatological event. Well, here it is. So he told me and gave me an interpretation. The four great beasts are four kingdoms or kings, depending on your translation, that will rise from the earth. But the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever, yes, forever and ever. Okay, it's like, what does this mean? Okay, here's the main thing. There's going to be four kings or kingdoms that are going to come up out of the earth, and then in the end, the saints will inherit all their kingdoms. Good news. It's like, well, wait. What was going on right here? What is all this? Daniel does the same thing. Because the angel just told him, there's going to be worldly rulers, but in the end, the saints are given the kingdom by the Son of Man. Okay. Verse 19. Then I wanted to know the true meaning of the fourth beast. Okay, I get it, but the fourth beast that was different than the three beasts that ended up having 10 horns. Three of them were eliminated by the one horn that was very boastful and proud. What is that all about? Why did you even bother to tell me that? At the bottom line, what's the bottom line? Here, if you want to take the shortcut through prophecy, we win in the end. It's like, and that's kind of what Daniel was told by the angels. It's going to be fine, Daniel. Yeah, but what's all this? I want to know the meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others. He points out it's different than the other three beasts. It didn't end and start. It wasn't the same. And most terrifying with its iron teeth and bronze claws. Now we had bronze claws. It's like, this is not a mere animal. This is a beast, but it's like a machine. The beast that crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. I also want to know about the 10 horns on its head and about the other horn that came up before which the three of them fell. So he wants to know, how is this different than the other beast? What about these 10 horns and then the one horn that destroyed the three? Daniel's asking the same questions we're asking. So again, Daniel had the vision, but Daniel doesn't know the meaning of this vision at this point. Came up from the horn, and the horn that looked more imposing than the others and that had eyes and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I watched, this horn was waging war. Now, this is new information. Now, see, he's saying, he gives you more information what he saw. The reason he's wondering, because this horn, he says, as I watched in the vision, he's recalling the vision, as I watched, the horn was waging war against the saints and defeating them. He says, this horn was defeating the saints. Until the Ancient of Days came and pronounced judgment in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came when they possessed the kingdom. So during this time period right here, this little horn is going to be crushing. Now, if we put this in historical position, we've moved past the coming of the Messiah and the Jewish age. We're into, in a sense, the end times right here. Maybe if we want to call it the 70th week that's coming up in the book of Daniel. We're past. So this would be, you know, believers. Is it just the Jews? Or is it believers? Is it Gentile believers? But it's saying, the problem that he's having is it's this little horn, it's destroying the saints. He gave me this explanation. This is Daniel. We got some more information. He's trying to put the puzzle pieces together. He says, the angel says, the fourth beast is a fourth kingdom. Okay, we know this. That will appear on the earth. It will be different from all the other kingdoms. Okay, yes, we've heard that, but how? And will devour the whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. In other words, not serving it as a government, but crushing it for its own advantage. The 10 horns are 10 kings who will come from this kingdom. So if this is the Roman kingdom, these are 10 rulers who are going to come from the Roman Empire that are going to continue the crushing of the world for their own advantage. Will come from this kingdom. After them, another king will arise different from the earlier ones. He will subdue three kings, or maybe, you know, kings and their kingdoms. He will speak against the Most High and oppress his saints. So when he says speak against the Most High, he may put himself in the place of the Most High and oppress those who follow the Most High and try to change times and the laws. So this one right here is talking about, I don't think this one has appeared yet, because he's going to be the one who appears that meets the coming of the kingdom. And so I think this is yet eschatological, it's yet future. This individual is going to become the lawless one. It's going to be called the Antichrist. It's going to be called the beast in Revelation. It says, here's what he will do. He will speak against the Most High. He'll oppress the saints and try to change the set times and the laws. The saints will be handed over to him for a time, times, and half a time. And there's your 3.5 year period. The saints will be handed over to him. And again, is this the like we talk about the 70th week, the first 3.5 years, or the second 3.5 years, the time, times, and half a time, that make up the 70th week? If it's the first 3.5 years, it would be the church that's being persecuted if you are in if you're not pre-trib rapture. Because in the second half, the Jews are protected. During the first half of the tribulation, the Jews are worshiping in the temple. They're saying peace, peace, safety. During this half, they're not oppressed by the little horn, because they're hidden, they're sealed by God while he's pouring out his wrath on the earth. So this would seem to be, again, those are some things to think about, and those numbers are coming up here later on in this book. But he's going to change. Notice what he's going to do. Change the set times, he's going to change the laws, and he's going to oppose or oppress the saints for times, time, and half a times, which is 3.5 years. But the court, right here, the court will sit, and his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be handed over to the saints. Interesting, not to God. God will come and judge, and in the judgment, he's going to remove at least this little horn, and then take the kingdoms that were ruled by Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome, and hand them over to the saints. He's going to set up his kingdom, but his kingdom is going to be given to the saints to rule with him. That's where Jesus continually talked about people ruling with him, him distributing awards or cities or places to rule. The people of the Most High, his kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. You know, all the rulers, because they've been placed in power by him, they'll worship him. Now notice these kingdoms right here. These were all temporary kingdoms. Babylon was replaced by Persia. Persia replaced by Greece. Greece replaced by Rome. Rome morphed into whatever this is. And this is cut off and replaced by the kingdom of God. But when this kingdom comes, there's not going to be another kingdom. This kingdom is the final kingdom. And notice, I mean, once again, how are you going to read this? This kingdom is in the place where these other kingdoms were. These other kingdoms were not spiritual kingdoms in heaven. They were in the Middle East. They were ruling and reigning territory that involved Jerusalem. This kingdom is going to replace these kingdoms, which I think is screaming a literal millennial kingdom on the earth. Again, I'm finishing this chapter. The kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. This is the end of the matter. I, Daniel, was deeply troubled by my thoughts, and my face turned pale, but I kept the vision or the matter to myself. The only reason we know this is he wrote it down and was asking questions, and it ends up in his book. But he didn't run out and, you know, start a ministry, write a book, have a podcast, or start live streaming with his vision. So there it is. We got to pick up in chapter 8. When we see chapter 8, we're going to get more details about Persia and Greece right here. These two kingdoms, the goat or the ram and the goat. And the ram is going to have two horns, Persia and the Medes. And the goat is going to have one prominent horn. It's going to trample this, and that's going to be explained here. And it continues on. All right, are there any questions? I want to ask anything. Anybody want to say something? Did it flow? Did it make sense? I mean, we don't have all the answers, but again, we're taking all the eschatology verses and laying them out there, and at least we're familiar with them. So we can read forward, we can read back, and put these pieces together. Yeah. Daniel, yeah, it's like, well, I don't understand that. Neither did Daniel. So it's like, but yet it's all going to come together. Yeah, we'll keep studying. I'll pray, and we'll go. Father, we do thank you again for the chance to be here. We thank you for your truth. We thank you for your word. We do ask that we would handle these things diligently, that we would humble ourselves and not bring our own interpretation, our own thoughts, but allow the word to transform our thoughts, transform our lives, and bring us into a place that we can be conformed into the image of Jesus Christ and his understanding. Again, we thank you for this opportunity to be alive at this time in history, and ask that we may serve you at this time while we wait for your kingdom to come. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.